highlight to Kevin, who picked us up at the airport, to all of you for being so patient. It's great to be here. It's great to celebrate independent media. It's been amazing to be on this tour. This is, I think, our 13th or 14th city right now. We began on Labor Day weekend in the Cape in Massachusetts. Provincetown on Friday night of that weekend. Saturday we went to Nantucket. Nantucket is a very interesting historic place. It's where Frederick Douglass first gave his speech against slavery for abolition, trembling, his body shaking, his power in that he was speaking from his own experience. He had come from the eastern shore of Maryland. That's where he was born. He had been a slave himself as a child and as a teenager. And when he was a teen, he almost didn't make it. He was handed over to what is known as a slave breaker. His name was Edward Covey. Edward Covey's home was called Mount Misery. And he almost killed Frederick Douglass, but Frederick Douglass survived. He fought back. He went north and he changed the world. Mount Misery today is owned by the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. It's his vacation home. He bought it in 2003. And he bought it to be just down the road, about a quarter mile down the road, from his close friend, the Vice President, Dick Cheney. The night before we were in Nantucket, we were in Provincetown. That's where we kicked off. In each community, we celebrate independent media, whether we're inside an independent bookstore or doing a fundraiser for a station. And there it was WOMR, Outermost Radio. And we pulled up to Provincetown High School. It was getting dark, and there was a couple at the steps with a pickup truck, and I couldn't quite see what was inside, but then I saw there was this casket in the truck bed. And the husband, Carlos Arredondo, started to speak very quickly. I was just about to go in and talk, and he told me about his son, Alex Arredondo, who had been sent to Iraq. And he told me how Carlos, who was talking to me, and his wife, Melita, had just moved to Florida in 2004. And it was Carlos's 46th birthday on August 25th. And his wife wasn't home. He was with his mother, and he saw a Marine van pull up, and he thought somehow Alex had come back from Iraq and was surprising him. Instead, the Marines got out, and they told him that his son Alex was dead at the age of 20 years, 20 days. And Carlos lost his mind. He went into a frenzy. He begged the Marines to leave. They didn't. He begged them again. They didn't. And he went into the garage. He got cans of gas and a torch, and he went to their van, and he started to destroy it, just to wreck it. And he poured gas, and his mother was extremely upset, and she was screaming at him, and she was trying to pull him out of the van, and he got gas on him, and that triggered the torch when his mother was pulling, and it blew everything up. And he was burned on about a quarter of his body, and it was at that point, as he was on the ground and the van was in flames, that his wife pulled out. Wife seeing her husband burning and learning that her stepson was dead. At which point his younger son, Brian, who was 17, who was in Maine on summer vacation, called his father to wish him a happy birthday. And he just heard this frenzy, this commotion. He heard someone screaming about the press, and he turned on TV, and he was watching his father burn on the ground, and that's where he learned that the brother he loved, the brother that he emulated, the brother he would follow anywhere, was dead. Just one story, no judgment. Carlos had to heal physically and emotionally after that, and was all bottled up. Until the summer of 2005, when Cindy Sheehan went to Crawford. And that's when Carlos found his voice. Cindy Sheehan went to the presidential estate. We won't call it a ranch because it's not one. We call it in static Cindy's Crawford. That's how it will forever be known. this grieving mother, who the night before was at the Veterans for Peace convention in Dallas, and said she couldn't enjoy a vacation. So since she was in Texas, she'd head to Crawford, didn't really know where it was, figured it couldn't be that far, it's Texas, and made her way and took up residence in a ditch outside the estate, and said she just wanted to have an hour with the president, with the man who had sent her son to his death, the commander-in-chief. She said she had one question: for what noble cause did my son die? And she waited, and she kept asking that question. The White House press corps was there. The embedded press corps, whether it's embedded in the front lines of troops in Iraq or whether it's embedded in the political elite, it was there. But beware of even that press corps in the dead of summer, 110-degree weather, when they didn't have the access they were used to enjoying. In the book, we call it the access of evil. That's trading truth for access. You know, we need a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state. And so they didn't have access because the president was on one of the longest vacations in presidential history. And here was this relentless woman who kept asking this question, just asked for an hour of the president's time. And so they took up the call, and they asked the president if he would spend an hour with her and why he wasn't. And his response was, I have to get on with my life, too. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reported that day when he said that, that he had mountain biked for 2 hours. He had gone fishing. He had gone to a Little League game. He had napped, and I think he'd done some reading. And Cindy wouldn't give up. And the press asked her, how come you haven't spoken out before? You're so articulate. You're so eloquent. And she said, I have been speaking out. You just haven't been listening. Now, if you listen to KPFK, if you listen to or watch Democracy Now!, you'd heard Cindy before. We'd gone down to the inauguration day, 2005, the second inauguration of President Bush, very cold winter in Washington. And Cindy Sheehan and Celeste Zapala, who lost her son Sherwood Baker, first Pennsylvania National Guardsman to die since World War II, and others had made their way to the Pentagon on the eve of the inauguration. They'd called ahead. They'd asked to speak with Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. No one got back to them, so they thought they'd try to visit. They were met in the parking lot, not by an envoy who would say, you know, the secretary's not available, but if you have a letter, or someone, God forbid, who might offer them some hot cider. You know, these were the mothers of grieving mothers who lost their loved ones in Iraq. But no, they were met by the security, you know, black-clad security outside the Pentagon, and they were turned back at gunpoint. Well, beware of mothers who have nothing left to lose. Eventually, Cindy made her way to Crawford, and she inspired so many. She came out of a movement, and she inspired a movement. And that's something that the media doesn't cover, is movements. When forced, they will deal with an individual, isolate them from the movement they come from. And Cindy is the first to talk about the movement. In fact, I was just yesterday, we were in, we're in Oakland, and a much older man came up to me and said, you know that we were the first ones to have Cindy speak in Northern California, he was. And he said they invited her out for July 4th. It must have been right after Casey died. He died on 404-04, April 4th, 2004. And they invited her to speak. She was nervous. She said she'd rather just sit there. And then as she heard other people, she stood up and she spoke also. So people come out of movements and then they build movements. I mean, think about it. Let's go back a little in time. Something else the corporate media doesn't do very much, and that is bring you historical context. You know, you can't do this with the average 8 or 9 second soundbite. And we lose so much, because the only thing you can do in that amount of time is repeat the conventional wisdom which is not very wise. You know, that's stuff that you keep hearing over and over again on all the networks, that small circle of pundits who know so little about so much, explaining the world to us and getting it so wrong. We need to hear the voices of people in all different communities, and we need to hear the history. Well, like Rosa Parks. Now, here is an example of a woman who we did hear about this past year when she passed away, when she died. A remarkable woman, December 1st, 1955. We all know the story how she refused to get up on the bus because to let a white passenger sit down. And the media told that story again this year, and I think it inspired many just to hear it. But they got it wrong again, because they said here was this tired seamstress who just couldn't take it anymore. She was no troublemaker. Yes, she was. She was a first-class troublemaker. She was the secretary of the local NAACP in Montgomery. She worked under E.D. Nixon, or with E.D. Nixon. He was the president of the NAACP, and he came out of radical labor politics. She had gone to the Highlander Center, had trained, had strategized, not just cared about ending segregation, but what is the most strategic, effective way to take on this issue and actually win. She'd even sat down on the bus before and refused to get up. But this was a moment, a kind of tipping point. And that's why you can never predict what's going to happen, when it's going to happen. You can create circumstances that might create that moment, which is why you should never, never give up hope. But on this day, December 1st, 1955, it happened. And Rosa Parks was so incredibly brave. Just think back a few months before. Money, Mississippi, Emmett Till, 14-year-old boy. His mother in Chicago sent him to go into the country for the summer to be with her family. And Emmett was killed. This white Klan, still not even fully investigated or people brought to justice 50 years later, but murdered him, brutalized him, ended up in the bottom of the river. And his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, did an amazing thing. When his body was sent up to Chicago for the funeral, she said, I want you to open the casket. I mean, open the casket. His head was like 5 to 10 times the size it should have been. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry. What a lesson to the press today. And thousands streamed past Emmett's casket. Jet Magazine published the photographs. Other black publications did the same. Millions saw them seared in the memory of a generation and all history. Rosa Parks and Mamie Till Mobley, they helped to launch the modern day civil rights movement today. Remarkable women. And now you have a new generation of women who are speaking out, like Cindy Sheehan, like Patricia Roberts from Georgia. She lost her son, Jamal Addison, first National Guardsman to die from Georgia since World War II. She went to Crawford, to Cindy's Crawford. She had started a fund for young African-American kids, you know, that they should have some other way to get a college education than have to go into the Army. Nadja McCaffrey from outside Sacramento lost her son, Patrick McCaffrey. She had already engaged in her defiant act when her son died. He wanted to give something back to this country. It was just after 9/11. He joined the National Guard, had a wife, 2 kids, said, I want to be there for my country and to protect it and also in time of natural catastrophe. And then he's deployed to Iraq. And he said, what's the connection? I want to protect my country. What is the connection? Now, I come from New York. My governor is George Pataki. He went to Iraq. He came back. He was visiting. And he said that he wants to take a piece of the statue of Saddam Hussein, you know, in Fierdo Square that was pulled down, so famous in the United States. We saw it thousands and thousands and thousands of times. So let's think of what's famous. What is the image that is emblematic to us of the invasion? I think it's probably the statue because we saw it so much. What's the image that most people in the world think of when they think of the invasion? Probably the Iraqi prisoner standing on a box with a hood over his head, his arms out, and a Christ-like figure with electrodes dangling from his fingertips. The media should be bridging the gap, this huge gap between what we see, how we perceive ourselves, and how the rest of the world perceives us. And we have to be projected to the rest of the world through something other than a corporate lens. It is too dangerous. And it does not represent the best of America. Most people in this country, if they understood, if they saw those images with the same frequency that they saw the statue going down, would say no. So Nadja, when her son's casket was being brought home, Sacramento International Airport, simply invited the press to take pictures. Now, why would this be a defiant act? Because President Bush has invoked the executive order that says you can't film, videotape, or photograph the flag-draped coffins of soldiers coming home or body bags. President Bush knows the power of these images. Think about the girl burning with napalm in Vietnam, naked, running down the street. And these are the images that helped to end the Vietnam War. And so she said, take a picture, snap away, film, videotape. My son didn't go under cover of darkness. I don't want him coming home in darkness. That was Nadja. She went to Cindy's Crawford. And then there's Becky Laurie. A few nights ago, I was in Minneapolis celebrating KFAI, Community Radio. And it was a wonderful event. Well, a few years ago on Memorial Day 2005, I was going through Minneapolis up to give the commencement address at Northland College in Ashland, Wisconsin. I picked up the Pioneer Press, and there was an article that said Death in the Family. And it was about the state legislator, Becky Laurie, who before the invasion, she introduced a resolution opposing war. But it wasn't about that. It was about her son, Matt, who died in Iraq 2 Memorial Days ago. And Becky Laurie made her way to Crawford. And when Democracy Now! Was there, we interviewed all these women. And State Senator Becky Laurie said, you know about the deaths of our children. Who are going to be our future leaders? Well, I think these women have answered these questions. These women with nothing left to lose, they are the future leaders of this country. Cindy's Crawford represents a movement of thousands of people. Carlos Arredondo found his voice when he saw what people were doing, and he started to drag a coffin around the country. That was his act, and tell anyone who would listen about Alex, and through Alex, talk about his feelings about the invasion. He's gone to Crawford. When we were in Provincetown, he'd just come up from Waco and Crawford. He's been to the Capitol. There's pictures of him with the coffin going across Capitol Hill, talking to Congress members. Sometimes he has a miniature coffin. Sometimes he has a full-blown coffin. And at Provincetown High School, he had the hanger with his son's military uniform. He had the boots. He had a teddy bear he had when he was a child. He's got lots of photographs. And they were showing me the documents, all the different pictures they had. And documents. They're concerned now about their son, Brian. He was 17 when Alex died. He's 19 now. And he's getting aggressively recruited to go to Iraq. They showed me the National Guard letter. They couldn't take it because it's the original, but I wrote it down, some of what it said. And it starts off by saying, Dear American. And that's interesting because Carlos, the dad, he's from Costa Rica, has a thick accent, and, you know, that's a country without an army. And he has applied for citizenship over and over again here in the United States. He just can't seem to get approved, though he has made the greatest sacrifice one could make, maybe more than dying for your country, giving his son and losing his son for this country. But he hasn't quite merited becoming an American citizen yet. Well, it says, Dear American, and then it goes on to say to the potential recruit, it talks about how serving your country is so important, especially in times like Katrina. And that's very interesting that they would raise that at the very beginning. Because where were the National Guard when this natural catastrophe hit? They were in Iraq. But there was an interesting side effect of the Bush administration not responding quickly in the case of Katrina and the levees breaking. It was a remarkable, remarkable failure. One might call it criminal neglect, right? The hurricane hits on Monday at the end of August, Tuesday the levees break, and where's the Bush administration? It was already predicted, the president had already been briefed. Well, he was in Crawford on vacation, but he did leave, but he didn't go to New Orleans. He went to California, and he did allow the press to take pictures of this. He was strumming on the guitar of the country singer Mark Wills, whose signature song is Wish You Were Here. We write about this in the first chapter. Could have been the theme song of the people of New Orleans. And it wasn't just President Bush not responding. Vice President Cheney remained on vacation for days later. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice in New York buying shoes at the high-end shoe store Ferragamo, taking in Spamalot Broadway. We're talking about Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, playing tennis with Monica Seles at the Ferragamo shoe store. One of the customers yelled, "What are you doing shopping when people are drowning in New Orleans?" And they took her out. That's the customer, that is. Andrew Carr, the GM lobbyist who became the chief of staff, he no longer is, was vacationing in the Northeast. And the people of New Orleans, the city of New Orleans, was drowning. The corporate media did the right thing in that case. They simply went to New Orleans. 90% of life, as Woody Allen says, is just showing up. And they did. And a side effect of the administration not responding was that there were no troops to embed with. And here were these reporters floating free of their handlers. And it was astounding what we watched on television. We saw bodies floating by. Well, the Bush administration whipped into action. They tried to invoke an executive order saying, again, you can't show the bodies. And the editor of the Times-Picayune said, you've got to be kidding. I remember seeing a young woman reporter who interviewed a man who'd come up out of the water holding his boy's hand, said he was in the attic with his wife holding her as she slipped away, and she said, take care of the children. And then he walked off in shock with his boy into the water. And the young woman reporter started to cry. That is reporting from the victim's perspective. That is reporting from ground zero. And we saw the effect. It galvanized a nation. Just what we saw on our TV screen. It didn't matter if you're a conservative Republican. It didn't matter if you're a progressive, if you're a Democrat, if you're an independent. That was not the issue. Humanity in this country, not to mention around the world, was just horrified. And a side effect of the reporters being there and not being embedded was when the government said, we're there, they said, no, you're not, we're here, you're not. They challenged the government. Could you imagine, for just 1 week, if we saw those images on the ground in Iraq, if we saw the babies dead on the ground in Lebanon, if we saw the women with their legs blown off from cluster bombs in Iraq, if we saw the soldiers dead and dying, not to mention the overall civilian population of Iraq. For just 1 week, we saw what the rest of the world sees. Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. This is why we need an unembedded, unimpeded, unfettered, independent global media. The power of the media is that it presents a level playing field for everyone to be able to speak, for us to communicate with people we wouldn't normally know, and to hear people who can't usually be heard, especially people in this country now who are targeted. America's the greatest country on earth for some, but for others, it's a very frightening place right now, and we have to stand together so that no individual can be targeted. And I didn't say we have to agree with each other. I'm sure we could have a lot of fights today. Well, I was just in Baraboo, Wisconsin at the Fighting Bob Fest last Saturday, and this girl came up to me, high school kid, wearing a sweatshirt, that's the motto at their school, that said, "Great minds don't think alike." We don't have to agree with each other, but we have to stand together to prevent the targeting, the scapegoating of individuals and groups. In this case, it's Arab Americans, it's people of South Asian descent, it's Muslims in this country. And I'll just end with a story that's not so far from here. It's the story of Ra'ed Jarrar, you know, the Iraqi blogger. He's an architect. He lives here in this country. He has a green card. He was in San Francisco. Now he's just moved to Washington. And two nights ago when we were in D.C., he spoke with us that evening. And I'm looking forward to seeing, perhaps if you want to tell your friends tonight at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church, our celebration with KPFK, seeing you. But Ra'ed was going across the country. He was at Kennedy Airport, and he was getting on his JetBlue flight, and he was stopped. He was stopped by four officials, TSA and JetBlue, and they told him he couldn't get on the flight if he didn't take off his T-shirt. And you know how sometimes you put on a T-shirt, you don't even know what you put on, and he's looking down, wait, what does my T-shirt say? Oh, it's the black T-shirt with the white letters that says, "We will not be silent." And he said, "What's the problem with my T-shirt?" And they said, "It's very threatening." And he said, "What's threatening about 'we will not be silent'?" And they said, "It's not the English letters, it's the Arabic script above it." And he said, "But that's just Arabic for 'we will not be silent.'" And they said, "We don't have a translator here, we cannot be sure." They said, to wear a T-shirt with Arabic script on an American plane right now is like wearing a T-shirt that says, "I am a robber," and walking into a bank. So he said, so is Arabic now a terrorist language? They insisted that he cover his T-shirt. The JetBlue official, I think, went off and bought a T-shirt, got him one to cover his T-shirt with. You know, he thought about fighting this, but he was nervous looking around. Is he going to get deported? Is he going to be sent to Guantanamo? Is this what it's going to be for? And he needed to get home. So he got on the flight. Well, they held the other passengers, and they put him on first. He'd reserved his seat long in advance. It was in the front row. He had planned to sit. But they put him in the back of the bus, I mean plane. And then they brought the other passengers on. The next day, after we broadcast Ra'ed's story, and this is the hope, and at the end of our book, we have a chapter on voices of hope and resistance. This is the hope. It's people taking action. A group of women came into Democracy Now! Studios. They were all wearing that T-shirt. And I said, "Well, what are you doing?" They said they had to leave quickly because they were all getting on flights. And I said, "Where to?" They said, "It doesn't matter." So they, when they came back, we had one of them on, Laurie Arbeiter. In fact, she's the one who had given, these are Artists Against the War, given Ra'ed the T-shirt a while before. They had started making them on the eve of the on the anniversary of the invasion, March 20th. And after Democracy Now! Did the story, the corporate media picked it up huge. It became a huge story. And here is Ra'ed, who was speaking in Washington the other night. He said, "It's just unbelievable. I mean, it's important. But of all the stories he's covered, he's blogged about, I mean, he comes from Iraq, the horrors of Iraq, that this is what they pick up on." Even though he felt very violated, and he's going to pursue this legally. It's amazing the moment that something breaks through. And Laurie gave him the T-shirt, and now, once the corporate media picked it up, and by the way, you know, our motto at Democracy Now! Is steal this story, please. I call it trickle-up journalism. They don't even have a real website. You can go, you can email wewillnotbesilent@gmail.com. And you get these T-shirts. Thousands of people are ordering them. They translate them into Spanish, into French, into Hebrew, into Farsi. Often you'll see on TV, they'll show the Arabic script, but it's the Farsi. Well, they don't know the difference. But anyway, they're just, they're now saying that they're going to print it in the original German. Why German? Well, World War II. Sophie and Hans Scholl were a brother and sister who were not Jewish. They were Christian. And they thought, what can we do in the face of this atrocity? We can at least let our fellow Germans know so that they can't say we didn't know. And they started to hand out pamphlets, the White Rose Collective. And the fourth pamphlet they handed out said across the top, "We will not be silent." Hans and Sophie were taken by the Nazis and they were killed. But that philosophy, that motto, lives on. It is ever important, and it should be the motto of all the media. We will not be silent, and we will not let others be silent. Because those people in this country who deeply care about peace, September 11th, by the way, is the 100th anniversary of Satyagraha, Mahatma Gandhi in South Africa challenging racism, deeply believing in peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience. Those people who believe in peace in this country are doing things in their little and huge ways, alone or together, every different which way, are not a fringe minority. You are not a silent majority. You're the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media, which is why we're calling this 80-city tour Break the Sound Barrier, Democracy Now! Books and